should always remember that. Welcome again. This is a continuation of the budget review process, which I trust and hope one of the members at some stage we will sit down and reflect on it and assess the extent to which it is being implemented and our responsiveness to it and its impact, as well as likely impact. If I can just take a few minutes and comment on that, because it's quite a paradigm shift from the way we've been addressing reports and the accounting or accountability practices by the executive, that is the department in particular this time. Today we have the department itself to take us through its annual report of 2011-2012 financial year. And just a small comment, you may recognize that we as committee members are not in full force. The unfortunate thing is that we are stretched. Some of us have to go to other committees, and we just have to limp along with that, and probably we have to be also innovative and creative and see how to ensure that we maintain a good standard of our work, notwithstanding such a pressures of having to stretch us between two and at times three committees. And surely we need to be, as I say, quite innovative about that, because we still have to do our work and not just maintain the standard, but even improve it. Having said that, let's get our apologies from the committee secretary.
Thank you, Chairperson. The following apologies: Honourable Lucas, who's attending the Portfolio Committee on Transport; Honourable Salau, who's attending the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry; and then Mayor Matibela indicated that she had to leave early, Chair, as well, at around 12 o'clock for this appointment. And then also apologies from the Minister of Energy and the Deputy Minister of Energy as well, Chair, unable to attend the meeting. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. I know they're very, very busy scheduled. I really sincerely trust and hope one of these days, at least particularly for days like these, that at least one of the ministers be around, you know, just to pave the way. It's a wish and a hope, because one has to face realities as well, you know. Because life has to go on, the department has to deliver. I'm the first one to be, you know, sensitive to that. But still, it's appropriate to express that wish and hope that once in a while, you know, if they can come, just to share it with us. But at least she was, oh, where she was around at least on Wednesday? No, Tuesday. Yeah. But, of course, she's been doing some good work. But you like this week, we really wish and hope that the work she's doing this week will come up with the outstanding results and impact thereafter, not only for the country, but also for the region. Can I hand over now to the department to take us through their report? I also suggest in our heads that they would have to, from time to time, do some leg stretching, because what I sense, even in the terms of the thickness of the document, that the report is quite voluminous. We really have to ensure that we concentrate and get through it meticulously. Over to you, Susan.
Chair, I have quite a number of people from the department. I think what I will just, I will simply just introduce the ones that are going to present, because some of the people here are subject matter experts that are going to be supporting the Deputy Director General. I'll start with Mrs. Zhu, the Deputy Director General responsible for compliance and Chief Operating Officer. and Mr. George.
Yes, that's on that. Particularly for Prof, to a lesser extent, but particularly for Mark Ferguson, it would be good that they get identified because she's not, she doesn't know some of them, in fact, in most of them.
Thank you, Chair. This Mrs. Zhu, the Deputy Director General, responsible for compliance and the Chief Operating Officer, and Mr. George Mguni, DDG for Corporate Services, and Mr. Ombi Apane, the Deputy Director General, responsible for Policy and Energy Planning. Mr. Apane, please feel free to go ahead. Okay. And Mr. Zuzumele Mbambo, Deputy Director General, responsible for Nuclear Energy. And Mr. Sidiso Mkubela, Deputy Director General, responsible for Hydrocarbon and Petroleum Regulation. And our Deputy Director General, the Chief Financial Officer, Ms. Yvonne Chetty. The other Deputy Director General, Dr. Vusi Barnard, is currently in India at the moment. So basically, we've got only one vacancy for the Deputy Director General. So far, we've managed to fill most of our vacancies. We're supposed to have about 8 Deputy Director Generals, and today we have 6.
Which vacancy?
We're left with it for the Clean Energy, Deputy Director General for Clean Energy.
I'm sure we need to know the Audit Committee community as well.
Yes. We have got the Chair of the Audit Committee for the department, Professor Gordon. I'm sure there's no relation with the Minister of Finance. And okay, thank you very much, Chair. Basically, the presentation is going to be made by those Deputy Director Generals that I have identified, and I'm simply just going to do a bit of scene setting. So what we're going to be looking at is what is it exactly that we have done in the department. So last year, in November 2010, we did our strategic planning session for the 5-year period up to 2014. And during that process, we came out with 7 strategic objectives which are aligned to the government 12 outcomes, as well as to take into account the new government outcome-based planning approach. And our strategic plan and our annual performance plan were based on several assumptions that included the availability of finance and HR resources. So basically, I think we were quite optimistic at that time that we're going to receive both, which we are going to elaborate later. And then, of course, the department, we are committed to the provision of an enabling platform for other sectors to speed up economic growth and decent job creation and sustainable livelihood. Now, if I can just indicate that on the year under review, which is 11-12, we firmly believe as a department that the credibility in the South African energy policy trajectory was enhanced by the RTT procurement program that we championed, and which I must add we have received quite a lot of local and international acclaim for it. We now need to assure that we collectively give the final push, in other words, amongst other things, to ensure we reach the requisite financial close so that we can start looking at subsequent windows. And then on the geopolitical front, members will be aware that we had to contend develop with a response plan to the sanctions by the US and EU on the Islamic Republic of Iran against their nuclear program. So the vulnerability, of course, of the refining sector at the time was also exposed with a number of refinery shutdowns, which diverted some of our attention into monitoring the contingency plans. Now, what have we done with regards to those strategic objectives? So what we did was we made sure then that our strategic objectives are aligned to various government outcomes as aligned in presentation. But the outcomes that we identified as where we're going to make the biggest impact were the government outcome number 4 with regards to job creation and economic development, and also government outcome 6, which refers to the infrastructure development, and also government outcome 10, which is the protection of the environment, and then government outcome number 12, which refers to the good governance for effective and efficient service delivery. With those few words, Chairperson, I'll then request then the Corporate Services DDG, Mr. George Mngoni, to elaborate on our performance under the year on the year under review.
Good morning, everybody, and thank you, Chairperson, for the opportunity to allow me to present both the achievements and non-achievement areas for corporate services. As you can see, our presentation for today will focus on the key focus areas for 2011-12. I will not deal with the introductory remarks as the DG has already done so. We'll also focus on the key performance targets in line with our predetermined objectives. And finally, I'll deal with the challenges that we face as a department within the area of corporate services. Chairperson, the main focus areas for corporate services for the year under review was the provision of human resources and auxiliary support services, the provision of legal support services to the minister and the department, the provision of communication and knowledge management support services. As far as key achievements or partially or non-achievement areas for corporate services is concerned, we have finalized the HR plan for the department, and the implementation thereof has commenced. You'll remember, Chairperson, that this is in line with the management framework, you know, as given to us by the Department of Public Service and Administration. The organizational structure, which is one of the key aspects within this plan, as well as the framework for occupational classification, was not achieved because of the long or prolonged consultation process with the employee organizations. I say prolonged because it has taken much more than it was anticipated. We've done this, Chairperson, to ensure that the employee organization, as well as, you know, other staff members within the department, do have ownership of the structure, so that when other processes are being rolled out, you know, they become very easy. The matching and placement of staff, which is also dependent on what I have alluded to, which is the organizational structure, was delayed because it would have been very difficult for us to proceed with the matching and placement of staff when the employee organizations or other staff members in the department were not in support of the revised organizational structure of the department. In as far as HR policies are concerned, we have finalized all HR policies, and we are in the process of implementation. And the turnaround time for filling of vacancies was improved remarkably to a 3-month average throughout the year. I'm aware that in some departments, you know, it is quite difficult, but because of the introduction of strategies and intervention, on average, we've managed to maintain, you know, a turnaround rate of 3 months throughout the year. Interventions to maintain a vacancy rate of 9.6% against the cabinet-approved baseline, you know, of 15% were also implemented. And all performance agreement and the work plans were finalized before the 30th of May 2011, as required And in those instances where people did not submit, particularly SMF members, their performance agreements prior to the 30th of May, we have taken appropriate disciplinary action, and sanctions for non-compliance have been imposed. Just as an amount indicates that in as far as the directive from DPSA and from ARNET is concerned, is that all those persons that have not submitted their performance agreement as at the end of May will not be entitled to any benefits as well as any pay progression for the ensuing year. So we are busy implementing that. The performance reviews for staff was also finalized before the end of June, and the public service wellness framework was also approved and implemented in the first quarter of 2011. The skills audit and plan were finalized and submitted as required to, you know, the relevant departments. We've also managed to finalize the HR strategy and training plan before the end of June, and the implementation is also ongoing. We have managed, Chairperson, to train 443 employees in both administrative and functional areas in line with our workplace skills plan. We have also exceeded the 50% female representation, and you know, we've also addressed all presidential hotline issues, you know, as was reported and referred to the department, and we've continuously maintained, you know, that level of performance. In terms of records management, the plan was compiled and is approved by National Archives, and we are in the process of implementing the plan, and the security risk management plan is in place, and implementation is also going, ongoing. We've also crafted standard operating procedures and contingency plan, and we are also implementing those. And I must say, Chairperson, we have acquired alternative office accommodation at the Department of Public Works. We did indicate at some stage that the space at the previous building, that is Traverna, was becoming limited, because when we relocated that building, we relocated the SA Department of Minerals and Energy, and with the split, the office premises space became limited, and we had to look around for alternative office space. Then on the legal services front, all requests were finalized, and a target of 50% was exceeded, with 66% of requests received dealt with within the prescribed time frame. Chairperson, we had set this target because of the capacity constraints that we were faced with when we were doing our, you know, our strategic planning session, but because of the commitment of staff members who were also prepared to work voluntary overtime, we've exceeded that target. On the communication front, the communication strategy was implemented. We had committed to develop and implement the communication strategy, but because of a capacity constraint, the chairperson, we could not finalize the strategy, but, you know, we did manage to implement the communication plan. The communications policies and procedures would not be finalized, you know, as I've indicated, because of capacity constraints, particularly at the SMS level. Chairperson, we did not have, you know, the chief director as well as the director within the structure, and it really became difficult for us to finalize policies. But I must indicate that the moment those posts have been filled and policies and procedures have been finalized, as you will see in our quarterly performance report. In as far as the external projects, including public participation programs, as required, Chairperson, we have continuously managed the public participation programs, and we have managed to do around 15, but if we look at other events that were also coordinated by the Chief Directorate, you know, beyond public participation programs, we have achieved, you know, a target of 47. Daily and weekly media monitoring and daily media liaison services were also provided as and when required, and the internal communication plan was also developed and implemented, and the event calendar was developed and implemented on an ongoing basis. And the charters and all this is available on our GOE website or internet. And in as far as marketing and advertising and branding plan is concerned, this was developed and implemented, and publication services were also established and developed, established and implemented. The stakeholder management plan was developed and implemented, except the strategy because of lack of capacity, as I've indicated, to do so in the relevant unit, that is the communications component. The task management management strategy was developed, but approval was delayed due to, you know, a planned relocation to the alternative new building, which we had to vacate because of, you know, limited space. Chairperson, at proceed, I'll deal with challenges, which I believe, you know, are very key. One of them is the recruitment of persons with disabilities. We could not reach a target of 2%, but we've now developed a strategy, and the strategy has been submitted for consideration, and, you know, with the hope that it will soon be approved and implemented. But in some areas, we have already received persons with disabilities. Another challenge of the implementation of the structure at macro organizational level. This has most challenges relating to reporting and lines of authority. You know, as the DG has indicated, that we are in the process of finalizing the filling of posts at leadership level. This has created problems in a sense that, you know, whilst we feel this vacancy is at a macro organizational level, because the structure was not yet finalized at that point in time, those persons that were affected, you know, were getting a bit confused in terms of reporting lines. But, you know, following the decision that was taken by the leadership that we have to address matching and placement, you know, of the affected employees, I must indicate, Chairperson, that processes are currently in the process of being streamlined. So we're no longer experiencing serious problems in that area. Establishment of the Knowledge Management Center, you know, as well as the development and implementation of the strategy and plan, this challenge has also been addressed following, you know, our relocation. And I must say it has been addressed partly so because the knowledge management strategy is still due for submission, but we now have, you know, a knowledge management center. So we can safely say that soon this will be history. On that note, Chairperson, thank you very much.
Several high class.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chair, I will cover some of the figures that need some highlights. There are disclosure notes which provide a breakdown of some of the amounts with the reasons and explanations for the expenditure. So where I do need to pause and explain, I would do so. I will, however, mention some of the findings by the Auditor General that was presented yesterday and the reasons thereof. I think we do need to explain some of them. Adjustments made to the annual financial statements. The Auditor General did allude to one of them yesterday. But I want to say, Chair, it did not affect the income statement, balance sheet, the cash flow statement of the department. It was only a disclosure note which did not affect the cash of the department. So it's merely an additional note to the balance sheet that was adjusted. But I will cover it as one of the findings when I explain it. So all quarterly reports that have been presented for the last financial year that ended 31 March 2012 have been accurate in terms of the time of presentation of those reports. The adjustment that the Auditor General referred to was a year-end adjustment, an as I say, I will cover it later on. And the financial statements that we will present now have been prepared on a cash basis. So it means only cash movements that actually went through the bank account will be covered in financial statements, and that is the basis of how it has been prepared. So it means anything that actually happened only, not on normal accounting basis as the other corporates would do it via the accrual system. So that's an important note. The year under review, 2011-12, is the second year the Department of Energy has been operating as an independent department. The only change from last year's financial statements to this year's presentation is that there are comparative figures. It will be the 2010-11 and 2011-12 figures being compared line for line. There has not been a significant increase in the department's budget allocation between the years 2010-11 and 2011-12. Of the 12% increase between the 2 years, bulk of it, that is 10.6%, went to transfers and subsidies. The remaining 1.4%, which is a very small percentage, remained for the department's operational expenditure. The challenges of the inadequate baseline after the split from the Department of Minerals and Energy, it remains with the department. However, substantial work has been done between the Department of Energy and National Treasury, the DG of the department and the DG of National Treasury as engaged as well, and many other officials within the department and National Treasury to try and address some of the funding challenges. We're using other alternate methods and finding some solutions. From the 2011-12 total budget allocation of $6.2 billion, 95% went to transfers. And as alluded by both the profs yesterday in their presentation and the Auditor General, you could see with this amount of transfers that we make from the department, it is evident that more oversight monitoring is needed and more funding to have those functions done effectively by the department is needed. And it gives you a breakdown. The biggest recipient of those transfers was for the Integrated National Electrification Program, receiving $3.2 billion. Transnet New Market Product Pipeline, $1.5 billion. Next up, $586 million. Energy Efficiency Demand-Side Management, $398 million. And the balance transfers to state-owned enterprises and smaller programs. The remaining 5% of the budget goes for operational costs, which covers goods and services, that's all our operating costs for rent, rental of equipment, etc., traveling, and it covers the salary bill of the department, a little bit of capital expenditure as well. So in total, at 31 March 2012, we've used 99.6% of the budget, and when we closed off the book. Here is the statement of financial performance for the year ended 31 March 2012. The total revenue. Revenue includes petroleum licensing, a little bit of interest, request for information, commission on garnishee orders, and current expenditure. Includes all operating expenses and compensation, goods and services, transfers and subsidies, which you know about, capital expenditure, and payment for financial assets. This is a small amount, but it was laptops that were stolen, it was actually written off. For the year that ended, there was surplus of 30 million rand. 26 million was for the voted funds. This was actually an amount that was requested as a rollover. And I will explain the how much was received from the rollover. Departmental revenue, this was subsequent to year-end transferred back to the revenue fund at National Treasury. This slide gives you an overview of the budget and the major spending areas. Of the 6.2 billion rand, as I said, 6.1 has been used, so it equates to 99.6% that was effectively used for the year. The remaining percent that's unused has been committed at 31 March 2012 and requested as a rollover. And as a breakdown, the only figure that I would perhaps speak of is capital assets. There had been a delay in the spending. It was due to the relocation of our office accommodation. But as I say, the money has been committed, request for rollover has been done, and approved by National Treasury. Budget overview by program. I'll cover all of the programs, the administration. It tells you how the $6.2 billion has been split between the various programs. Administration has $204 million. Energy policy and planning has $1.5 billion. Energy regulation, $541 million. National electrification program, $3.2 billion. National energy and regulation, $643 million. Okay. Analysis of the financial information. The department's total spending for the year was $6.174 billion. The $26 million that has been unspent, we've just received a confirmation from National Treasury. It has now been approved. A total of $12.95 million, that is about 49%, of the overall balance of $26.65 million, remaining are for the transfer payments. These transfer payments specifically relate to EDI Holdings and the local organizing committee balances that remain at year-end. The composition of the overall balance of $26.65 million, that is the remaining portion that was unspent, is broken down as compensation for employees, goods and services, transfer payments of $12.95, that was the biggest amount, and then capital assets. Thank you. A rollover request was submitted to Treasury for the unspent amount of $26.65 million. And as I mentioned, all has been approved, and there is, I think I covered everything here. The main reason for the unspent amount at year-end was goods and services. A bulk of it was for membership fees that we had transferred, but due to processes that are followed at National Treasury, Reserve Bank transferred them just after year-end, that is the 2nd and 3rd of April, that is why it remained unspent at year-end. But as I say, it was committed and subsequently completed. The transaction has been completed. The analysis of financial performance continues, if I can just ask. Transfer payments. There was an amount of $11.8 million that should have been transferred to EDI. But as the department does provide oversight function for EDI as well and the wind-up process, the department, the SOE did have sufficient funding to cover their liabilities and their operating expenditure till the date of closure. So any more money transferred to EDI would have not served the department or the EDI owings any better. So a request for rollover has been requested to Treasury to be used for the ADEM program within the Department of Energy. And it has been approved. The CAPEX funding, it was earmarked for capital assets, and it could not be used due to the delay of the relocation, which I've mentioned, but it has subsequently been approved. This slide will give you an overview of all the transfers that happened. It had a budget of $5.8 billion to be transferred. We did transfer almost all of it. The only two that didn't go through was EDI Holdings. As I said, it was an informed decision, a decision that has been made by the shareholder, that is us, the Department of Energy, and the local organizing committee. There was a remaining of $1 million left. But of that $1 million, we also did try to request for the rollover because we did have needs for it in the department. The National Treasury did give me $200 million of it. So. Lastly, Chair, it's the top five expenditure of the department. On the top of the list would be the compensation of employees. That is of the 5% that remains of our budget. Most of it went for compensation, travel and subsistence. The travel and subsistence, subsequent to December 2011, there have been an increase in travel. Amongst them was increased travel regarding the security of supply within the hydrocarbons branch. March 2012 was Energy Month, hence there were travel costs that did increase. Consultants and contractors includes the Auditor General fees, which is the bulk, energy planning modeling, the 20-year liquid fuel roadmap, temps that were hired for critical skills that was needed in the department. Lease payments covers the equipment for rental of equipment and all of those operational costs. And the last one, operating payments, covers the bulk of that amount would be membership fees and storage of assets. She in the statement of financial position, the unauthorized expenditure, I think I need to pause here, 14.8 million rand. This was an amount that was brought forward from the previous financial year of 2010-11. This was when the Department of Department of Minerals and Energy split. There was a transfer made to Mthombeni Municipality, but due to a system error, the payment was rejected. The payment subsequently went through in the new financial year when the department was in its first year of operation, that was 2010-11, and there's nothing irregular about the payment. It went to the correct recipient, the correct amount. The only thing it went through in the incorrect year in the new Department of Energy, it should have gone through in the Department of Minerals and Energy. So by the classification of the Auditor General, it's clinical in its way that they do the classification when it's irregular. In this payment, as much as it's gone through the incorrect financial year, that is the irregular part. Nothing else about this transaction is irregular. It awaits National Treasury approval. So that is why it appears again on our financial statements. The cash and cash equivalents are all the cash balances which is to be surrendered to National Treasury at the end and which is done accordingly. Prepayments and advances, these are travel and subsistence advances paid to employees when they travel abroad. And receivables are staff debts and other debts from other government departments. The amount of investment of 2.2 is the next investment. Voted funds to be surrendered to National Treasury have been done, and payables that are still due is the income tax that had to be paid over, pension fund payments that had to be made. And that takes care of that ledger. Yeah, I've explained the unauthorized expenditure, but it's further explanation of what happened. And I want to say that we are just waiting the approval of National Treasury on this one. The irregular expenditure has been raised by the Auditor General yesterday. It relates to the lease payments of our office accommodation for Trevena Campus. Here's the irregular part. It was subleased from the Department of Minerals and Energy that the Department of Energy in assigned with the Department of Minerals and Energy. However, the only irregular part in this transaction and reason for it to be classified as irregular is the payments were made directly to the landlord instead of the department who we had subleased it from. However, in July this year, the irregular expenditure has been condoned by National Treasury. So this has been covered by the Auditor General yesterday, but that's explanation. I can skip this slide because I covered each and every one of them that I've spoken of already. It's just to mention that the department did receive an unqualified opinion without an emphasis of matter, which has been improvement from the previous financial year. However, there were some findings by the Auditor General, and plans have been implemented, and there is a plan of action, and the internal audit department of the Department of Energy will also audit these action plans to ensure that there's timely closure of all findings before the interim audit will be conducted by the Auditor General. And I think as a way forward in terms of improving on the performance of the Department of Energy, we have insisted that the interim audit takes place a bit earlier so we could have sufficient time to have improved controls if necessary should the Auditor General find there are some areas that need improvement. But here I want to also raise the Auditor General's report that had been part of the annual report, starting on page 119, going on to page 123. There are just two or three items that I think is worth mentioning, and that were the findings that the Auditor General did make the house aware of. Employees of the department proposed...
Slow down. We need to be with you at 119 to 123. Okay. You can start again, please.
Chair, it's in the annual report, the printed annual report on page 119. Stop there. But I'm not going to go through the whole report. I thought I would just pick up the ones that the Auditor General raised. The first one is point number 17. That was the material adjustment made to the financial statements. There was a 10 million rand adjustment made to the financial statements. It was an adjustment made to a disclosure note, and this chair was a human error. It was a purchase order that was raised for the office accommodation for the month of April. The person in the department raised it one day before the end close, purely off by error. It has, however, been rectified and is only a disclosure note, not the cash movement of the department. That's note number 17. Note number 18 is DORA, the Division of Revenue Act. There have been non-compliance issues with the municipalities in terms of reporting. And Yeche, I think the UNEP department has rolled out some improvement plans. And I think when the UNEP department does speak, they will give you some of those of how they plan to improve their performance and to avoid non-compliance issues for the next financial year. Then, Chair, on note number 19, the accounting officer did not take effective steps that relate to the leases. But here, as I say, Chair, sufficient steps have been taken. In fact, the Director General of the Department of Energy did meet the Accountant General of National Treasury to resolve the issue. And it has been subsequently approved. It got approved, condoned. Note number 20, employees of the department performed remunerative work outside their employment. Yes, Chair, there were two employees that didn't declare their interest. And this is an HR matter, and disciplinary action is underway in that area. And point number 21, quotations were awarded to bidders who didn't submit declaration of interest. Here we had used the services of Palama, one of the suppliers of Palama, and they had gone through the competitive bidding process to have these supplies of their database. And as a national department, we are entitled, we are allowed in terms of the framework to use suppliers of other national departments if they've gone through a proper competitive bidding process. So in this instance, we've used the supplier from Palama, that was AFRI22, but unfortunately, the two employees that are part of AFRI22 did not declare their interest, and they work for National Treasury themselves. However, going forward, if the department uses supply from other national departments, we will request in writing a confirmation that all processes have been followed effectively before we use them. 22, quotations were awarded to bidders who did not submit a declaration. So that's, we have done that one. 22, quotations were awarded to suppliers whose tax matters had not been cleared. Chair, these quotations were awarded to suppliers with tax matters. It mainly related to the public participation programs that we do run, and it was the municipality's database of suppliers that we used. So the suppliers are on the database of those municipalities who have gone through the process of being an approved supplier on their database. So here again, we are allowed to use the suppliers, but as a preventative measure going forward, we have now decided in the department that the municipalities that we engage with or partner with, they will procure and we will reimburse them. So we will not engage with their suppliers directly to prevent such a finding again. And it also is related to other events that we have, that we partner with other national departments, like COP17. Other departments might have engaged the supplier. We just had to pay our portion of it. So that was the reason sometimes that we are caught in that crossfire, unfortunately. And the Auditor General is also of opinion, if I do use the supplier, I'm equally liable. But as I'm saying, Chair, that going forward, we would ask for something in writing from the national department that the proper process has been adhered to within the framework. And the last one, Chair, I think that is 25. Reviewing and monitoring of compliance with applicable laws and regulations supported by National Treasury. this relates to its tax certificates as well, and it was also for the public participation programs and other events where the department was involved, like Corps Engine. So that in a nutshell tells you where the foot or where did the department contribute and why the fundings are here in the financial statements. But enough steps and internal controls have now been implemented to prevent it happening again. Chair, with that, thank you.
What about 26 and 27?
Sorry, Chair?
No, not 27, 26.
I think 26. Sorry, Chair, that is the 10 million rand that we spoke about. A material adjustment that was made. So it's saying what controls, the Auditor General saying there were insufficient controls to ensure that these errors could have been picked up before year-end. So I'm saying sufficient controls have now been implemented to prevent such errors, such adjustments being made after the financials have been submitted to Auditor General for audit. And yet again, we will use the internal audits to have a top review before we submit to the Auditor General as a mitigating, as a measure to avoid such errors. Because they are saying, sitting here, Chair, the controls were not monitored and reviewed to ensure accurate and complete financial and performance reports were supported by evidence and reliable information to avoid material adjustments. So the material adjustment was the 10 million rand.
No, it's fine. It's just that I don't remember. Maybe it's fine, thing because it comes under 17 and it comes under 26. Okay. No, I know you've explained it. I wish there was someone from the AG. Yes, you know. Because what confuses me is that why should the same thing appear twice? Maybe. Look, keep that in mind. Maybe anyone with the requisite expertise, maybe the audit committee chair, you know, if you could just help us on that, you know. Not now. No, now, if you could just note it. Mrs. Nelly, one along the line. Oh, thanks.
Thank you, Chair, honorable members. Our next branch is the branch that's responsible for the governance and compliance, giving support to the minister and to the ministry and the department on issues of ensuring that the department's outcomes of any strategy and the risk management together with our corporation can effectively be implemented in the department. We're also responsible for monitoring and evaluating the department's program performance information and the reporting thereof against the predetermined objectives. We're also responsible for monitoring compliance of our public entities, compliance to legislation, finance and administrative requirements, as well as providing an oversight function to the entities that are reporting to the Minister of Energy. And also responsible for handling and coordinating the international liaison in the field of energy. Honourable members, this is a fairly new branch that was established together with the new Department of Energy. And in the area of strategy and risk management, which is our first area of responsibility, during the year we were successfully hosted the department's second strategic planning session, out of which we came out with our 11, 12 to 15, 16, which is our five-year strategic plan, according to the new planning framework of government, as well as our 11, 12 annual performance plan, against which we are reporting right now. We also make sure that those two documents are aligned, of course, to the government outcomes-based approach. The department also, during that period, we revised our strategic plan for 11, 12 to 15, 16, just to make sure that it was the one we had for 10, 11, that one did not take into account some of the requirements that were later provided in the year by the planning department in terms of how that we should be presenting our plans to the public. So all these were tabled last year on time, in February 2012, and were later presented to this committee together with the SILA Committee on Economic Development. In the area of strategy and risk management as well, we will also look at risk management. And this way, last year we were fortunate that we could get some funding to establish the risk management unit for the department, although it's still not fully funded, I mean fully capacitated. This unit is responsible for risk management together with the fraud prevention function. During the year, we're able to conduct a risk assessment for the department, compile our comprehensive risk register, which was in turn utilized by internal audit function for the provision of their audit plan. We also, as a unit, we finalize our standard operating procedures for various functional units within the department, and some of which we also assisted the department in developing some for other units within the department. I think the challenges here, high-level challenges for this particular area of responsibility, was the implementation of the enterprise-wide risk management strategy for the department. I'm saying that the implementation in terms of saying that we have developed all the necessary documentation, all the, we've got the strategy, we've got the implementation plans, we've got everything, but everything we're doing in the department at the moment, unfortunately, is actually manually done. We don't have, as noted in the next point, a risk management tool as a department. But we've been lucky that National Treasury has agreed to actually donate a software or a tool that you can utilize going forward, which will be implementing. So that has caused a lot of delay in terms of implementing whatever strategies we've put together for risk management in the department. The other non-achievement or partial achievement that we experienced in this area last year was the provision of the department service delivery plan. In terms of the requirements of the DPME, every department is supposed to present a comprehensive service delivery plan that talks to the inputs from our stakeholders in terms of the inputs from our SOEs and all the role players within the NH sector, what expectations do they have from the department and what plans does the department have. So what we're working on at the moment is just to finalize that process, make sure that within our planning session due next month, we'll be able to accommodate that. We're working closely with the DPSA to assist us in that environment because one of the challenges we don't have capacity for that function in the department. Our next area of responsibility covers monitoring, evaluation, and reporting, which, as I indicated, is responsible for the coordination of the department's reporting function, looking at the information that we have presented and also corresponding with the necessary government structures in terms of the information of how the department has performed. We have gone through the process during the year. We produced all the four quarterly reports that have been audited, as well as production of the annual report for the department. The challenge is there, as honorable members noted, that in the annual report, the auditor has indicated that we had a 43% target achievement in terms of our target in the department, in terms of our achievements. As the DG put it very nicely earlier, we had very optimistic planning as a department. And one of the reasons for that is that when we were planning here in November, we were in negotiations with National Treasury, which of course we started in 2010 as the Department of Energy, to look at our baseline. So the plan that we put together as a department were on the hope that we would be receiving some additional funding from National Treasury to entertain our baseline for starters before we look at anything else. Unfortunately, I think earlier in the whole presentation also indicated that unfortunately we haven't had that increase in terms of our budget, the Department of Energy, since we started this department in 2010. So we didn't receive enough funding, so we had plans that we had already put in place in terms of our strategic plan, in terms of our annual performance plan, which we could not carry out. That's the 43% target achievement from the department. And also over and above that, we did have challenges, of course, of the capacity of the department, because we've been operating at less than 60% capacity from the department since we established this department. So putting all of those together, it actually had a serious impact on us achieving the targets that we've put forth for ourselves. I think to respond also to that is that we this year have decided that we will be having a mid-term review or a mid-year review, because as soon as we've given a confirmation from National Treasury as part of our ongoing discussion that we are not receiving any money next year, we have to, in fact, not next year for this year, we have to go back and review what we have so that at the end of the year what is audited is against what we should have done in terms of the funding that we receive as a department. So we'll be doing our mid-year review next month just to look at if anything changed in terms of our funding and in terms of our capacity. The next area of challenge that you also experienced last year was the timeliness of management reports. It has also been reported with in the Auditor General's report yesterday morning that we did have a number of instances where our quarterly reports, for instance, were not submitted on time. This, fortunately, we managed to report or to present our annual report on time, which should have been a serious compliance issue. But in terms of our timeliness of management reports, I think the challenge here, honourable members, for the department has been that most of the work that we do as a department, we're doing it manually. Our management reports are consolidated manually. We don't have the appropriate software to make it easy for us and quicker for us to do our work. We have started the process in the district office of coming up with a software that will assist us in our management reporting. It is taking longer than we would have loved because of, unfortunately, once more, the issue of funding. But we're hoping that by the end of this financial year, we'll be able to implement that. That would improve tremendously the time taken to produce the management reports that are required for the department. The last bullet point on the challenges was the issue of, also been raised by Auditor General, was the issue of the department's standard operating procedures, that is a consolidated report for standard operating procedures, which we have finalized in the first quarter of this year to consolidate and have one document that talks to all the standard operating procedures of the department. Our next set of responsibility is state-owned entities oversight. I would say in this area, we are providing oversight on the five entities that the minister is responsible for. Together with that, we're also responsible for making sure that the boards of these entities constituted. Yes, that's the word I was looking for. Properly constituted. During the year also, we did, in the part of our oversight function, we do provide to the minister is to look at the individual submissions of the performance of the state-owned entities. They provide quarterly reports like we do. And those are analyzed by our section together with the support of the line function expertise in the aim of advising the DG, the Deputy Minister and the DG on the performance of those individuals. We look at the financial compliance, look at administrative compliance, also we look at performance against their predetermined objectives. In the area of EDI, we have been involved as the department, as the unit in the winding down of EDI. Line function, as shown, Mr. Pane will talk to that later in his presentation, is responsible for the technical side. We are also responsible for the administrative side, that is the winding down of the EDI. We have been engaged with the appointed administrator during the year to finalize that process, but unfortunately, by year end, as we had hoped, say that the organization would have been closed down and actually deregistered. We could not meet that target. What was outstanding at the end of the year, which I have to say unfortunately is still outstanding up to now, was the finalization of the CCMA process. Unfortunately, as the department, we don't have any control over that process. We have to wait for the CCMA and the labor court processes to carry through. So that is the one major outstanding item in that. But we are considering, we've had discussions with the administrator and the DG, considering one of the options of actually taking the funding that is left, otherwise the money that is in the bank of EDI and putting it aside and wait for a process while we close down the entity and deregister the entity. So the first option we're looking for should be implementing within the next couple of months. Hopefully by the end of this financial year, the whole process will be completed. As I've already indicated, those are the challenges in terms of our SOEs, the winding up of EDI, finalization of our SOE oversight framework. We do have a framework that we have been implementing, but we are hoping that by the end of last year, the Presidential SOE Oversight Committee's report would have been finalized and distributed or presented to Cabinet first and then to the Department for implementation. So we wanted to incorporate those into our framework, but it has been delayed, so that's the reason why our framework is still sitting in the draft position at the moment. One of the areas that was raised by the Auditor General in the report last year was the coordination and the alignment of the sector risk management between ourselves and our SOEs. So it's one of the areas that we'll be looking at this year. And of course, the issue of department's compliance monitoring, which is another function that requires a software in terms of that. We're hoping that we'll be able to finalize it by the end of this year as well. In the area of international coordination, that is the unit that's working closely with the department and the ministry in terms of our international engagement. Last year, I think the major activities for last year in this area were the hosting of COP, the co-hosting of the COP17, and also the hosting of the African Ministers Energy Conference, which was pre-COP17 conference that was held by our energy ministers. The unit also supports the international trips or visits that are undertaken by our principals. For example, last year we visited a number of countries. We just mentioned a few there. The Australia have only included the African ones. Over and above that, we did visit a number of other countries like South Korea, your Russia, your China, your UK, your Norway, in the areas of clean energy, in areas of nuclear, in the areas of petroleum. So we do have a comprehensive list which I'm made to believe that it was presented to this committee last month of September. In detail. Also last year what we were working on was the DOE's international relations strategy, which is important for us as it needs to be aligned to the government strategy or the DECO strategy. We also were on reviewing on all the international agreements and MOUs that were signed by the department or in the name of energy, some of which they fell under the DME environment. So we've compiled at least and we've looked at all of them to say which one are still relevant, which ones are complete, which ones are not complete, and what is the action going forward. Also last year, we also got involved in the agreements as part of our international engagement in agreements and declarations that were signed between our countries. Those are just some of the examples of the agreements and declarations of intent that were signed between our country and international partners. Also, the important area also for last year's performance was the issue of the SARI, which is the South African Renewable Energy Initiative, which was signed between ourselves and the United Kingdom, Germany, Denmark, Norway, and the European Investment Bank in terms of the provision of financial support for clean energy. I think the challenges in this particular area, what was not achieved, was the two processes of the approval of the international relations strategy for the department. By the end of the year, we had a draft, but it needed final approval, which was received early this year. And also, of course, the approval of the audit of the agreement signed by the department. So those are the two outstanding things as at the end of the year. That, Christine, is the brief report on the COO page. Thank you.
Thank you very much to the DG for the opportunity. Chairperson, honorable members, good morning. I'm going to present the branch hydrocarbons and energy planning. I am aware that members do know what this branch does, so I think in the interest of time, I will go straight to actually presenting on the annual report itself. So if we could go, with the permission, Chairperson, to slide 45, where the highlight of the year starts. Basically, in the year under review, we were able to ensure that the new multi-product pipeline is operational. The branch assisted to ensure that the line fill, which is basically diesel that was put in the line to actually make the pipeline operational, that basically was done through the facilitation by the branch hydrocarbons and energy planning. As a result of that, Chairperson and honorable members, we have a enhanced security of supply. We have two currently independent systems of bulk transport of petroleum products into the inland market. Now, one could say that perhaps that is not efficient, But there has to be recognition that, unlike many economies, the bulk of economic activity in South Africa is inland, and as such, if something were to go wrong with one of those pipelines, or with a pipeline, then we run into difficulties. So I think we derive comfort currently from the fact that we have two independent systems that can transport petroleum products. Secondly, in the year under review, we're able to conduct inspections as required in the Petroleum Products Act as amended. And we basically achieved our target there and exceeded it. We also were able to conduct sting operations with the law enforcement agencies to uncover illegal fuel sales. We had a very successful one in the Gauteng province, assisted by the Joburg Metropolis. Then on the area of licensing awareness campaigns, we were able to conduct one campaign of awareness, one for each province, as was planned in the previous year. The area perhaps that was not fully covered is the one on energy safety. And I think that it is an area that is receiving attention in this current financial year. We also participated as the department in the development of the coal roadmap. I think there is now an indication of how much coal we have and how we can better use that coal in the country going forward. There is some kind of map that has been developed, and there is a plan to further refine that work. We also were able to complete as planned the implementation of regulatory account system, and that was introduced into the fuel margins towards the end of last year. Basically, this allows us to have a set of regulation accounts that segment the value chain, wholesale, retail, and facilitate the rewarding of investments in the various segments of the value chain. And also prevent cross-subsidization, prevent a situation where wholesalers actually go and impinge on the margins of the retailers. Then we were also able to intervene in terms of job creation. We intervened last year in that we introduced a special dispensation for new retail sites. And we reduced, the law requires us to process those applications in 90 days. But we introduced a system where for the new to industry size, where information was fully complete, we indicated that we will prioritize those and do those in 60 days. Now, through that intervention, we're able to unlock accelerated job creation. There were 41 such sites, and if one looks at a site that during construction you have 150 jobs, and then post-construction you have an average of 20 jobs per site, we were then able to facilitate through this accelerated process 6,000 job opportunities if you combine all of those construction activities. We're also during the year under review, we increased the turnaround time for processing applications, especially those that met the acceptance criteria. One of the challenges that we're having, and we continue to have, is that the information that is provided by applicants, sometimes they don't attach certain information that is required for a decision to be made, in which case we are then not able to meet the 90 days that is prescribed by legislation. But we've endeavored to ensure that all those areas within our control, we are able to reduce the timeline. I must indicate here that there is an issue in the sense that there is a view, for example, from the Auditor General that the 90 days is applicable whether the information is complete or not. And that is an issue that we are still going to grapple with, I think, going forward. And there has been also an opinion that we have received to that effect. But I guess what this will lead to is that we may have to, for those that don't meet the criteria, we may have to reject within that 90 days. Whereas we're trying to facilitate and give people an opportunity to submit the information. But that's a matter that we're grappling with at the moment. We also, during the year under review, developed standard operating procedures for processes that we undertake, particularly on the licensing. And by doing that, we improved consistency in the application of the law. We also insisted in this process that all our staff that handle applications from members of the public basically have to do the PAJA course, promotion of administrative justice, because we're of the view that you cannot serve the members of the public if you don't, you haven't gone through that process. So we made that mandatory. During the year under review, we were also able to complete the blending value and break-even price of biofuels. We do admit that the support mechanism was not finalized, which would be how much support would be given for biofuels in terms of subsidy. But we will explain that later on. The regulations on the mandatory provision of energy data was promulgated, which has also, in our view, a significant milestone, because now we're going to be able to get data that we so desperately need for a credible integrated energy plan. Then the roadmap for carbon capture and storage was noted and supported by Cabinet during the year under review. And on the draft strategy we use for the integrated energy plan, in the year under review, we made use of the guidance that we had received from Cabinet to better enhance our work on the integrated energy plan. I'll talk to that on the next slide. We also completed the liquid fuel charter audit during the year under review. And then the Director General, on behalf of the Director General, the branch also spearheaded the response on the sanctions that were imposed on Iran. I must indicate here that this was a spanner in the works because we had to divert resources. However, we believe that it paid off in the sense that in as far as the U.S. is concerned, we were able to receive that exception. Unfortunately, we were not so successful with the European Union. we come to areas where they will appear, I think, as areas that were not completed fully or partially completed and so on, or not completed. But I think I need to set the context for the year under review. One is that during that year, we had a number of events, unplanned shutdown events, that had an impact because the team, the same team that has to develop these policies and plans, was then diverted to try and assist to deal with the contingencies as we had this event unfolding. All of the members would remember that during last winter, we had severe LPG shortages emanating from these shutdowns, and these were also taxing in the sense that we have, when we do have these events, we convene meetings with industry on a regular basis, and so what we had to do, we had to then have these meetings more frequently to ensure that we try and minimize the impact of these shortages. I have spoken to the issue of the sanctions, but there is another one that I think is internal, which is a context that needs to be explained, that we also embarked on a process, as I have indicated earlier, internally. We have a young staff complement that is a fact. We need to expose them. We need to give them the necessary, ensure that they gain the necessary confidence, but also the ethos, making sure that at all times you reinforce the ethos of service and accountability on the part of our staff. The first area where I can say that a lot of progress was made but not completed is the integrated energy plan. I will say here that it is very difficult to complete an integrated energy plan when your data is all over the place, when you don't have a mandatory submission of data from the role players. And that makes it difficult because you then are at the mercy of, you know, whoever has to submit the data. And without that, you definitely are going to perhaps plan for a demand that may perhaps may not actually materialize and so on. So we believe that the complexity of this task, in our view, was underestimated. We also had to build a team internally. We've attracted a lot of expertise internally into this unit, and we are confident now that, you know, even with the work that we're doing or work that is to be done in future, we will be able to do this internally within the department. The gas amendment bill was not completed in the year under review. I call this a work in progress for a reason, in the sense that a few weeks after the end of the financial year, the bill itself was sent for certification, and it is now you know, currently with the chief legal advisor. However, for the year under review, we do concede that it was not completed as planned. The petroleum products amendment bill that was planned was also not completed, and this was as a result of a delay that we had introduced because of the liquid fuel charter audit that was currently underway. That was the first thing. The second one was that the broad-based, the codes from DTI were being amended at the same time, and part of this, the rationale for amending the Petroleum Products Act was to actually deal with the issues of empowerment as well as enforcement. And we felt that technically we have to perhaps await the outcome of these processes. The regulation on clean up fuels specifications was not promulgated as was planned. We ran over time. Again, I think we have the benefit now of being in a new financial year, but these were then subsequently promulgated during early in this financial year. The regulations on mandatory blending of biofuels not finalized. I think again here, it's an issue of perhaps underestimating the task at hand. And I'm pleased to also report now that although it had not been done that during that 12 months, it has subsequently been completed and promulgated. The Integrated Energy Center program did not yield the two IECs that had been planned because of issues of completing land acquisition, the environmental impact assessment, as well as procurement processes. We did not do any IECs last year. However, I am confident that instead of doing the two for this year, we will do four. Because, you know, we've learned from the challenges of the previous financial year. The strategic stock framework, the finalization of that, that was not finalized, partly because not all of the activities in that area are within our control. The big one, in fact, it also impacts on cleaner fuel, is the financing part. Strategic stocks are going to require financing. How then do you begin to come up with a framework for funding strategic stocks, especially during a period of economic challenges globally as well as nationally? Then on the issue of the 20-year plan, we had planned to complete that. Now that was impacted upon by the request from the players for the data, submission of data. The players were supposed to submit data for the 20-year plan, ask for extensions, and those extensions led to other extensions, and subsequently we had, you know, we ran basically over time there. But also there is another issue here that was touched upon earlier, the issue of financial resources, because unfortunately this task we had to outsource, and that then meant that there's got to be the requisite funding. The fuel pricing framework, again, was impacted upon by resource constraints. We decided to do something different here. We felt that we need to drive this process internally as opposed to use of consultants so that we can build the internal capacity to ensure that this process can, you know, going forward, not extract a lot of financial resources from the state, that it can be done by people internally. And that, of course, means that you also have to build that capacity whilst you are developing the framework. I've spoken briefly to the principles for incentivizing investments in cleaner fuels. That, again, is an issue of funding. How are you going to fund, basically, these investments into refineries? Who is going to fund? Will the user be the one that funds and how do you burden the user in these tough economic times. So those are some of the issues that you know, we have to grapple with. Issue of timing. When do you time this such that you don't overburden the consumer? Then on the LPG, this was a calculated move. We decided to give the market initiatives that were underway a chance, and I think we got it right in our view, because the market has since responded with investments. They are, you know, filling plants that are being constructed all over the place. There are storage plants that have been constructed and that are being constructed. There's work on an import terminal in Saldanha. So the market has responded, and our view was that should we try and introduce something, perhaps we may introduce uncertainty, which is not necessary, and we held back on that one. And the way things are unfolding basically are in line with the thinking that we had. I must say that there may be a question about what about regulation of the pricing, but that is in place. We continue to look at ways of further extracting you know, efficiencies out of that process. Then lastly, the last slide is on challenges. I think what we have faced basically is, I've spoken to it already, the reluctance to submit. You know, when you're in a regulated market, there is always a reluctance to give your regulator everything, and because, you know, you fear that that may actually expose. So there are those issues, and we are aware that we also have to give the necessary assurance to those people who submit the data, that the data that they submit to us is secure, that it won't be used for other purposes, and that it won't be passed to people who are then going to use it to compete. So those are some of the issues that we are aware that lead to the reluctance to submit data. Human resource challenges, I think I've spoken to, the need to expose, retrain, you know, for a different environment. Then I think I've spoken to the issues of the refinery outages, the quality management system issues. We have started to improve our quality management system. As I said, we now have standard operating procedures for basically all the activities that we undertake, and that was done in the year under review. However, we have to keep on refining this management system. The last one, Chairperson and Honorable Members, is just pure inertia, because we are trying to redirect the big ship, where, you know, the whole ship of energy in the country, and I think it is, you know, difficult to make people understand that we've got to change the way we used to do things. We have to do things differently, but also restoring the balance between the regulated and the regulator. I think it's always a tussle, but we believe that we are well on track to actually convincing people that it is actually a win-win situation. Chairperson, thank you very much.
I've just been told he is ready outside. I think one of the members will be at it for some time. We are still going to be at it, isn't it? It's a good time for leg stretching and re-energizing. Thank you.
There's another.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson, honorable members. and DDG and DJ for providing me the opportunity to make this presentation. I'll be presenting for the nuclear branch, and I'd like to focus on the highlights for this reporting period, and then I will move, with your permission, Chair, to cover the way forward and the conclusions of the presentation. With that, I'd like us to look into slide 28. Chairperson, during the period of review, Cabinet approved the establishment of the National Nuclear Energy Executive Coordination Committee, which we call NNEEC. The aim of this committee is to oversee the rollout of the nuclear build program. The committee is headed by the Deputy President, is the authority for the decision-making, the monitoring, and ensuring the general oversight of the nuclear energy expansion program. In May, South Africa hosted the IAEA Second Regional Conference on Nuclear, on Energy and Nuclear Power in Africa. Such events are important in order to foster exchanges and interactions on regional approaches to the energy security. In April, South Africa participated in the review meeting of the Convention on Nuclear Safety, which culminated in June 2011 in the ministerial meeting on the Convention on Nuclear Safety. The significance of this meeting is that it allowed the ministers around the world to come up with an action plan to address the lessons learned from the Fukushima incident. Chairperson, during this reporting period, South Africa undertook the least stress tests or safety reassessment on its nuclear installations. Recommendations resulting from this exercise will be implemented to ensure safety is maintained. During this reporting period, Chairperson, the IAEA Safety Assessment Review, or the Integrated Nuclear Infrastructure Review, was initiated during the reporting period. The review will be completed in the coming financial year. The amendments of the fund legislation, as well as the development of the legislation for the long-term funding provisions for the radioactive waste management, are being undertaken within the nuclear energy policy and implementation. With that, Chairperson, I request to move to the way forward, that is slide 33. With regard to the way forward, we will continue with the preparatory work for the rollout of the nuclear build program. We'll continue with the implementation of the phased decision-making approach. We'll continue completing the IAEA integrated review infrastructure. We'll implement the communication and stakeholder engagement strategy, amendments of legislation to ensure that our legislation is well aligned will continue. We'll continue with the operationalization of the National Nuclear of the National Radioactive Waste Disposal Institute. We'll ratify the amended Convention on Physical Protection of Nuclear Material. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. With your permission, I will take off from where my colleague left off, and thank you for the opportunity, Honourable Members. I will be doing the part that deals with clean energy planning and policy, starting on slide number 72. In the interest of time, it's a fairly long presentation, but I will be jumping around, because I believe that you might be able to follow it easy on the slide. If I can start on slide number 75, this is just in terms of the highlights for the year, and then I will go into some detail around the problems and how we intend to deal with them. So that's not 75, it's the one before that.
basically around the renewable energy IPP program. The fact that there's some 72 billion rand has been procured out of Windows 1 and 2 from renewable energy program IPPs, wind, solar, small hydro, and CSP, due to be closed. There is some indication there as to the local content, but also we were asked to look at the potential for job creation out of the program, so that's defined on that slide. As you might well be aware, we have had some delays in financial close, which was supposed to happen in June this year, but we're confident that within the next few days we will start the process with the intention that by the end of this month we would have closed a whole lot of the 28 bids. If I move on to this slide, starting on bottom right-hand side, to date, as at March 2018, we had installed some 342,000 solar water heaters out of a TREF-funded rebate program. And going forward, we have received additional money, 1 billion rand this year, 1.7 next year, and 2 billion in the outer year, in order to reach our target of 1 million by 2014. So we're quite confident that that will easily be achieved. However, the program has now shifted to a strategy to try and localize those products so that we create local jobs and so on. So what the slide does is indicate what happens from 2012 through to 2013, so to 14, sorry, how we're going to make the transition. Effectively, what we're doing is we're changing the contracting model, as opposed to it being a rebate program under ESCOM. We are wanting to make a transition to only certain product that would be used, and that product would be aligned to SABS 1286. SABS 1286 specifies the local content of a designated product in terms of the Preferential Procurement Framework Act. So we believe that that is an exchange. If there are any questions around that, we can deal with them. But over and above that, there's a whole lot of elements within our energy efficiency strategy that is now...
If you could share this slide again, but remove the graph on installation and give it its own space, because it's a step plane. Thank you.
Not sure. I agree. Maybe we could have used it completely separate. It looks a little bit clogged up there. This is part of the energy, I was saying, the energy efficiency strategy. I was saying that a number of the elements have now fallen into place. Just to give you a sense over and above the energy efficiency program, the National Energy Efficiency Strategy of 2005 contemplates a 12% reduction in energy intensity by 2015. We introduced the National Energy Act, in terms of which we established an entity called the National Energy Efficiency Agency under SANEDI. Over and above that, we have promulgated energy tax incentive regulations under the Income Tax Act. And as a result, we believe that the framework, which is on the next slide, please, the framework around energy efficiency, and I'll come back to this one. Carry on, please. The framework around energy efficiency now makes for a very, if you like, positive contribution that we believe we can put in place. This represents the institutional arrangements that we intend to put in place in order to give effect to the provision of the National Energy Act under NEA, as I indicated, but also to ensure that energy efficiency is available to all licensees, and it is not just the preserve of ESCOM and so on, and that it is also aligned to government policy in the base. So that's the one element. We believe with this institutional arrangement, we will be able to address those challenges that we have raised. Can you go back to the previous slide, please? And what are those challenges? We have not been able, since the inception of the strategy, to monitor and to verify the achievement in relation to our intervention. So we intervene we believe we are making positive impact in energy efficiency, but we have not been able to quantify it. And in that regard, the energy efficiency target monitoring system, which covers all segments of the economy, is currently being developed. A little bit late, it was supposed to have been completed by now, but we're confident that it would be able to now start making a quantifiable, you know, relationship, or rather quantifying the energy efficiency achievements relative to the 15% target. Secondly, is that apart from the monitoring of the targets, there is also the verification aspect. In other words, where when we report, or ESCOM report, that they have saved 1.4 terawatt hours last year, it is independently verified according to some verification protocol that has been adopted. In that space, SABS, the South African Bureau of Standards, has promulgated a standard around the verification of energy efficient savings. Third element is the energy efficiency campaign itself, which was negotiated with the social partners at NEDLAC. Fortunately, we did not have enough funding to deal with that, and that's why it has not been as prevalent as what we would have wanted. There are elements in the residential space under ESCOM, including the 49M campaign, but there has been a sense that we need to cover a lot more than just the one ESCOM campaign, and because in the social partners agreement, it will cover industrial, commercial, residential, and so on. As an example, the government or the public buildings energy efficiency program would fall under a new initiative under this energy efficiency strategy. So basically what we're saying is that there have been those targets, we have not been able to achieve them, but we believe with those three elements of the energy efficiency campaign, with the ability to verify, with new institutional arrangements, we'll be able to make a lot more ahead when we can take some questions around that. Thank you, everyone, please. To the next point, which is around distribution infrastructure, that is on slide number, my slide says 65. Yeah, what we were supposed to achieve is to, or having identified a backlog in 2010 financial terms of some 35 billion rand of poor investment by municipalities and the ESCOM in distribution infrastructure, that something needed to be done. We call that ADAM, standing for the approach to distribution asset management. In terms of what we're supposed to achieve, ADAM in its institutionalization, but also in the way that this program would fund it, should have been at an advanced stage. We should have done all the metros by the stage, and this has been delayed. It has been delayed for two reasons. Firstly, that we had not been able to secure the leftover funding from the EDI holdings process, the EDI restructuring process. When it was terminated in December 2010, there was some 400 million rand that was available, and we had been in negotiations with National Treasury to divert it into this program, the ADAM program. Secondly, we had not been, or we have not been able to finalize the funding model as per the original plan, because as you're well aware, and I will come into some detail around that, that the multi-year plus termination of the ESCOM TERF application process is only now being undertaken. As such, the provisions under the tariff for funding municipal infrastructure rehabilitation will form part of that process. We indicate here that one of the things that we need to do, similar to energy efficiency, is that the funding would be ring-fenced, put into a separate pot, so to speak, and then municipalities and ESCOM would have to make applications that are pursuant to a business plan that deals with infrastructure rehabilitation. In that way, you are able to ensure that funding is used for the purpose for which it was intended. We're saying over and above that, one of the other elements that we need to put in place, and we have reached an agreement with the regulator, is that there needs to be enforcement in order to make sure that we do not put money into municipal infrastructure rehabilitation only for us to face the same problem again in about 5 years or so. So there are certain regulatory and enforcement provisions that will be put in place. You might also be aware that we are amending the Electricity Regulation Act. One of the issues around the Electricity Regulation Act is to introduce new regulations for licensing, and in that way we believe that the regulatory principles and the mechanisms around municipalities would be enforced. So that's the point of the slide. And the next one we're going to go into detail. Basically, if you can go to the next slide, please. Yeah. Basically, it shows the phasing out of this process, where we're at. We've done the business case. We have a sense how the 30 billion is made up through the different municipalities, metros, secondary cities, and so on. We have done a budget assessment. So phase one is largely done. We're now in between phase one and phase two, in terms of which we now wanted to say, how do we then pilot, you know, and those municipalities that have been audited. Eventually, NERSA audited some 80 municipalities about 3 years, 5 years ago, and those are the targets that we wanted to do. We're arguing that, in fact, it does not make sense to spend all of this money building new power stations and then leave a 40 billion rand problem at the distribution segment. If we can move on, just in terms of pricing and electricity pricing, one of the things that we had wanted to have achieved in our plan was to introduce inclining block tariffs so as to cushion the poor from increasing electricity tariffs. Incidentally, this is just one of the elements. We use inclining block tariffs, we use solar water heating, and we also use free basic electricity as the seat of instruments for cushioning the poor. Unfortunately, inclining block tariffs have only been converted in ESCOM areas where conventional and prepaid meters are involved, and only 60% of municipalities with prepaid meters, only 60% of municipal prepaid meters have been configured to facilitate inclining block tariffs. The main reason for this delay is the fact that there are municipal financial sustainability problems as municipalities introduce inclining block tariffs. As you can appreciate, it means cross-subsidies, and the extent to which municipalities can cross-subsidize between their different customer categories tends to be limited depending on the customer makeup within that municipality. Then the next issue I've mentioned around the tariff determination and the fact that we would align the tariff determination, the electricity pricing, with government policy, in particular the electricity pricing policy, as ESCOM applies for the MIPD. On the next slide, I think here we indicate, so we just go back and I'll come back to those. So we carry on. I just want to go to the graph. Forward to the graph. You're going backwards. That's right, yeah. This is an illustration, and so I apologize. It looks like in my head the logic is the other way around. I'm talking before the one slide ahead. So what happens here is we have projected the electricity tariff going into the future, the wholesale electricity tariff. You might be familiar with this graph. And we think that from about 2005, we have seen very steep tariff increases, mainly because of the build program, Midupikusile and so on. And in fact, if the entire IRP is going to be funded on the basis of current pricing principles, then we're likely to see tariffs going all the way to about 110 wholesale from a base of about 25 cents in 2005. So the challenge for us then, we make commitment in our plan, how do we make sure that we do not kill the economy and keep prices affordable. We're saying the number of instruments in electricity pricing policy, one of which is the extent to which ESCOM prices its assets or values its assets. Secondly, is the extent to which ESCOM receives a return as per the Electricity Regulation Act. And those two dotted slides indicate the cone of possibilities, where the top dotted trajectory indicates what would happen with the price trajectory if we followed the pricing policy, and the second year, the bottom one is how do we get an affordable price path, and the idea is to try and get to the affordable price path rather than to get to the top one. So if you go back to the previous slide, please, we're saying these are the principles that have now been included. Some of them were achieved already, but as I indicated, because MYPD is an unfolding process, it will only be concluded in March next year. So it's now last year's financial year and this year's financial year that this would be addressed. The methodology looks at making ESCOM sustainable without ESCOM necessarily becoming too profitable, but at the same time making sure that the pricing signals are adequate for investment purposes, just as some of those principles. But I think one of the most critical ones is the last point there where we say that we need to ensure consistency between price control periods. In other words, if you go back the last MYPD, we had a tariff increase of 35% in 1 year. And then the MYPD2, we had tariff increases of around 25%. So we're saying that, in fact, you want to have more moderate, you want it smooth out, you don't want these step changes in tariffs because they shock the economy. So that is now underway. To summarize, carry on, please. Yeah. We also we have made a commitment around CDM. CDM is a clean development mechanism in the renewable or clean development space under the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. What we do here is we give a summary of what has been achieved so far. The challenge is that South Africa and Africa do not necessarily enjoy the benefits out of carbon financing, mainly because the process that is defined requires you to follow a particular methodology, including registering the projects, registering them with the board in London for approval of the project and the carbon footprint, and therefore ultimately benefit from carbon trading. So as you can see, whilst we have 196 projects at that point, only 6 of them have actually, or 19 have been registered and only 6 have actually made it to, you know, to carbon trading, if you like. So the number of challenges there and that we are addressing in main about around making players aware of this opportunity and how to go about it. In fact, as we embark on the renewable IPP program, you will see a lot more of these projects making their way through to carbon trading. Carry on, please. We give a breakdown of the different areas, the different segments where these projects are registered and so on. Renewable energy, obviously, being the biggest opportunity for carbon trading, then energy efficiency, fuel switching, cogeneration, waste management, and so on. I think just to conclude, if you go to the next slide, we're saying that there are other key programs that are in place to ensure energy security, but in terms of previous financial year, you might be aware that we had just approved the integrated resource plan, so it is now being implemented. In fact, the one great point that we talked today is that in the next round, you will see what we're doing around the baseload program as well. It is not necessarily just the renewable IPP program that is taking shape, but also the baseload program. I have touched a little bit on the legislation. We believe that the legislation, particularly the independent student market operate legislation, by the end of next year, we should have some definition, more or less, including also the Electricity Regulation Act, and side by side with that, the revamp of the regulatory framework for generation capacity. And then lastly, the issue around the solar park. It is one of the things that we had committed last year. We have not reported on it. Basically, there is an issue around accessing land there, and that's why it has been difficult to do the environmental impact assessment and get the site ready. Thank you very much. If I carry on to the next one, it's on the integrated electrification program. Two of my colleagues are actually responsible. I'll be assisted by Mr. David Lyons, who is here, and my other colleague is unfortunately overseas, so I will try and assist them. Basically, what we're saying is that the biggest challenge that we have is how do we reach universal access. We said that by 2014, we would have reached universal access in formal areas. saying now we need to embark upon a new program or a new approach that would use both grid and off-grid solutions in order to fund this program. As you might be aware, this program has been dominated largely by grid electrification. And between ESCOM and municipalities, they do both the power infrastructure and do the connections into the houses. And in terms of the off-grid program concessionaires, we have five of them, do limited programs mainly in rural areas in Stoltenberg. We set targets, if you carry on to the next slide, we set targets around the numbers that we are going to achieve, 180,000 for grid connections, including 10,000 of solar home systems. Over the past 8 years, 5.4 million houses have been electrified, and we've installed 55,000 on the grid, and we've installed 55,000 odd solar home systems in those provinces, as indicated. We still have a bit of a challenge. If you go to the next slide, please. That on the one hand, this has to eliminate a backlog, but as you're well aware, we have a population growth. We have a growth in the number of households, so basically it's a moving target. That's number one problem. Secondly, is that just in terms of the amount of money that we put into the problem, it is not appropriate to completely eliminate the backlog. Why? Because there are increasing costs as you move into the rural areas. There's also inflationary pressure on soap costs is increasing, whereas the ability to achieve the connections, it declines as you go out into the rural areas. And as you can see from that inflation, the red graph just points out that in fact we are on a downward slide or trajectory relative to what we'd like to do. That's one of the biggest, those are two of the biggest problems. Carry on, please, to the next slide. We give a sense around backlogs. I'm sure you're familiar with this, Eastern Cape, KZN, surprise, surprise, Gauteng, mainly because of the informal areas. Carry on to the next slide, please. What are we doing then, or what have we done last year in order to deal with that? We have received some money, some 2.7 billion rands, split between ESCOM and municipalities, 1.7 on the ESCOM side, 1.7 billion and 1 billion municipalities and ESCOM respectively, and we achieved those numbers of questions as indicated. Just in terms of the solar, we do the same analysis, overachieved by about 268 questions relative to the target of 10,000. We also give a sense of how we have allocated the money, the backlog in the respective provinces, how much money goes into those, and you will see some correlation between where the money goes and the amount of backlog that resides within a particular province. Carry on. And the same within the ESCOM areas as well, indicating the provincial split. Next slide. I have touched on the challenges at the high level. We said that it's funding, number one, but also the fact that we're chasing a moving target. But in detail, there are problems with the implementing agents themselves, ESCOM and municipalities, but specifically on the municipal side. In fact, I think it's something that we have to allege about the fact that municipalities take 3 months from the time that we allocate the funding to the time that they actually do start with the implementation. That's one of the biggest problems, in alignment between the two financial years of national government and the local government. We say there is slow delivery. In fact, we have put mechanisms in place to make sure that we do not lose the money and send it back. Lack of skills within municipalities and municipalities performing within the time frame, you know, has resulted in a number of initiatives being put in place in the past financial year in particular to ensure that we do not lose the money as I've indicated. The non-grid program or the off-grid solar home systems program has one big challenge, and the fact that there is still some resistance. There is a sense that it is an inferior product relative to grid electricity, and a number of initiatives, and I think my colleague, Mr. McDougall, has alluded to integrated energy centers and so on. This is is mainly because the solar home system does not cover a thermal solution. So you need an integrated approach in order to make sure it does not get the negative, you know, resistance that the solar home systems problem. What we are wanting to do, or what we have done rather, is recently there have been some regulations promulgated in order to reduce the you know, cost, but to also increase the installations in certain areas. And so side by side with the renewable IPP program as well. Carry on, please. There are also issues around the electricity distribution industry itself. We mentioned that we have the ADAM program to try and deal with that, but as you can appreciate, where municipalities do not have bulk infrastructure, or if their bulk infrastructure is in a state that it cannot connect additional houses to the grid, municipalities tend to not want to use electrification funds to connect it. In fact, what they do is they want to divert the electrification money into infrastructure rehabilitation. So you have a situation where you have to find balance between those two. And we believe that ADAM will start addressing that problem. I have mentioned the issue about rural connections and funding. You know, we're saying that just because of inflation within the decline in our ability to increase the number of connections. Next slide, please. Just some quantification of the challenge is that 4.2 times more applications are received from municipalities than what is available, you know, in that financial year, particularly last year. But generally, it's like we only receive 50% of the demand out there. There is another side to it, I need to also add. Let's not create the sense that that's the only problem. The other side of it is that the municipalities, or shall we say, the ability to spend capital is also constrained. So it's not like if we give all the money that is required, we would be able to convert it into those tangible outputs. We also are wanting to leverage soft loans and grants to put into the program, particularly grants related to renewable or clean development. There's a lot of money around for projects in the clean energy space, and we wanted to deal with it. We raised it as a challenge, but it's something that is receiving attention. I have touched already on the difference in the financial years, the 3 months that does that. What this slide does is it illustrates the cost. I think we have touched on that, but it's a graphical illustration. As you can see, relative to when we were really, you know, flying, the costs have doubled from about 1996, you know, thereabouts. We're sitting now in 2010 with costs that have literally, you know, doubled and are increasing all the time. You know? Well, this is a lot more detail around the challenges, but maybe just to flag a few of the other general challenges. Remember, the electrification program is a service program. In other words, it services the housing infrastructure development program. So where there are no houses, we cannot electrify, and where there is late delivery of houses, we have a problem because we have to then reallocate funding and so on. And it's a very tricky situation to try and align with the housing program. Carry on, please. Just in terms of, to conclude, in terms of the way forward, there is, maybe I can jump to the slide, and I think maybe if my colleague wants to talk to the slide. We've put in place a new structure with the International Finance Corporation, which is a subsidiary of the World Bank. And basically is to take the electrification program to the next level in a way that elevates it to a strategic infrastructure program and to achieve universal access as planned. Incidentally, if we do not do this, it's going to take us another 20 years before we can achieve universal access. So if I can ask Mr. Lai to maybe speak to the next slide. Yep. Next slide, please. I'll just have it carry on. I've covered all these points here, I think. Yes, Dieter, yeah. Maybe start from this slide and then the last one, please.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Mr. Abani. I just would like to share, it's actually in relation to what the DDG already alluded to, the fact that we are setting action. This slide basically just speaks to the fact that the universal access is a function of funding. It just basically illustrates to us as well as that currently our funding is limited, yes, and our main focus is currently basically that we are trying to address the grid connections and to realize more grid connections. But what we have seen is that currently that we are not able to if we are using this very same fashion of how we connect, we are faced with the escalation of cost, and hence that we need additional funding actually to materialize more to reach our universal access. Hence we say that we need some sort of a mix in terms of that we have more reliance on renewables as well, renewable energy sources or alternatives, and that we also need to strengthen, to get more funding in the pool. What we have done is that as a department currently is that we were lucky or fortunate to obtain funding from the IFC, International Finance Corporation, to assist us in developing a new roadmap towards specifically the electrification in the country. This roadmap speaks to the fact that it actually showed us, and as well, our whole model actually is not going to address us in terms of the backlog. Firstly, it is quite clear from the other graph, so it's quite nice of it. But this is just showing us currently we will only reach universal access by 2025, and our risk is that our target for 2014 has then been compromised. So we need to get to alternative electrification sources in terms of households. If I can just go to the next one, which is much, yeah, the next one is, which shows actually the rate of electrification currently. If you will see the more, I think it's maroon type of color, we focus there on actually the solar home systems program that we have. Currently we are saying we want to reach 1.1 million. We are seeking the backlog at the rate that is currently at around about 3.5 million households. And the growth that we, in our calculations, we normally include growth to a level of 2% per annum. And that actually is actually aggravating our whole problem at the moment, because we can't keep up clearly to electrify households in the region of, we need actually now to move to a level of 340 households per year. And that actually is actually what we are facing as a department. So what we have come up now is that the roadmap is currently in a discussion format, document. It will be presented to the DG, I think before the end of November, and then we will try and roll it out, ready to speak to this. But what we will come up with within the roadmap is that what the DDG have already said is that we will need additional funding really to accelerate electrification in the country, and as well as to address the existing problems within the local sphere, where you will find that municipalities, for argument sake, is taking quite long in terms of procurement issues, and hence we projects have been taking very longer to be implemented, and as well as to realize those connections. So that is in short just the illustrations for the graph illustration speaks to.
Thank you so much. I think it's time now for the honourable members to make their comments and questions. I assume I don't think because of the time we allow people to ask whatever they want from whatever. The presenters are here, ever here. We don't want to confine and say I'm going to do this one and this another one finished. As I hand over to the chair.
Thank you very much, Prof. Just when we're ready, in terms of internal audit and audit committee, would you like them to present now or later? Kind of flow?
Please, Professor Gordon has indicated that you'd like to leave early.
If you don't mind, Honorable, that the audit committee records as well. I don't know that we have any documentation from the audit committee. I haven't seen any.
I've just been informed it's on its way for circulation.
Okay, but carry on in any case.
Thank you, Chair and Honourable Members, to give us the opportunity to present the function of the audit committee, which performs its responsibility in terms of an approved audit committee charter. Can you just move to the next slide, please? Basically, my presentation this morning, as you can see on the screen over there, covers the areas that we have looked at during the course of the year. This report is based on the audit committee report set out on page 94-95 in the annual report. So just to start off with our responsibility, we perform an oversight responsibility over areas covering internal audit, external audit, risk management, reporting financial and non-financial information, compliance with laws and regulation, and the internal control environment. I'm not going to elaborate on each of these. On the membership, the audit committee consists of three members. Independent members. We are all chartered accountants and specialists in our fields of governance. We were established in September 2010, so this is the now third year since we were put into office. Our mandate is to comply with responsibilities arising from Section 38(1)(a) and 77 of the PFMA and Treasury Regulations 3.1.13. We have adopted formal terms of reference, Audit Committee Charter, and we have discharged our responsibilities arising therefrom. Moving to the next area that we concentrate on is risk management. The department has established a process for the management and monitoring of the risk management process. This initiative was enhanced with the appointment of a chief risk officer in the current year. And I'll talk about the challenges later when we come to the conclusion as a result of these initiatives. The committee reviewed the strategic risk register during current year and recommended improvements to some of the processes. And what we have found is that the risk management process is still at an evolutionary stage and requires further equipment and improvement, especially in terms of resources. On the effectiveness of internal controls, we rely on the internal audit reports, the quarterly reports that are presented by internal audit, which is in-house, in terms of its approved annual and three-year rolling internal audit plan. Then we also get input from the Auditor General, and based on these reports, the internal audit report and Auditor General report, it was noted that there were some deficiencies in the internal control system during the year. The good thing is management has undertaken to address the deficiencies and to improve the internal control environment. The next area of responsibility pertains to quality of management reports. These are reviewed at the quarterly meetings, but we are not entirely satisfied with the content and the quality of the report, particularly the timely submission of the reports and the review thereof. We have made suggestions, and management has undertaken to improve the timely presentation and content of the required reports as suggested by us. Over the two-year period ending 31st March 2012, we have noticed an improvement in the reporting of non-financial information. When we get to the Auditor General's report, we find that they've also given an unqualified audit opinion on the audit of predetermined objectives in the current year. On the evaluation of financial statements, we have reviewed and discussed the Auditor General's financial management report with the accounting officer and management. an undertaking has been given to address all the reported items. We have reviewed and discussed with the accounting officer and management the 31st March 2012 audited annual financial statements for inclusion in the annual report. We reviewed and discussed the appropriateness of the accounting policies and practices. We reviewed and discussed the unqualified audit opinion. Now, this sounds strange. I spoke about an unqualified audit opinion on the predetermined objectives, but this pertains to the annual financial statements as a whole. And the CFO has already alluded to that in her presentation earlier. Nevertheless, the audit committee takes note of other reported items included in the auditor general's report, which the accounting officer and the management have committed to address in the ensuing financial year. On internal audit, we review the internal audit quarterly reports to ensure that internal audit activities are conducted in terms of an approved annual and three-year rolling plan. The audit committee, as in the previous year, again registered its concerns with the accounting officer and management regarding the adequacy of resources within the internal audit function. So of all what I've said so far, if you had to ask which was the main area of concern to the audit committee, this was the one particular area, the resources of the internal audit department. Although some enhancements have been made in terms of creating more positions, what we have found is that through resignations, the internal audit department still faced the challenge of resources. But apart from that, we also would like an evaluation of the internal audit function in accordance with the Institute of Internal Audit Standards of the Internal Audit Function. This is normally done once in 5 years, but because the department is new and we are already in the third year and challenges we have, we would like an earlier review. In July 2012, the Audit Committee had a meeting with the Minister of Energy and inter alia raised this internal audit capacity constraint. Assurance was given to address this problem. Continuing on internal audit, just to give some background information, the internal audit function of the DOE was established in April 2010 with three auditors. That capacity was enhanced in April 2011 with the addition of five auditors. A variety of audit assignments, including IT compliance, performance, and financial audits, had been planned and executed during the past two financial years. The level of assurance still needs enhancement. Co-sourcing had been arranged during 2011 and 2012, but the funding for such is received towards the third quarter, and this affects the performance of the identified audits.
Any other expand on that?
Sorry, Chair. What we are saying is, as a result of the shortage of internal capacity, for the internal audit to complete their annual plan for the year, they have to co-source outside firms to help them complete their assignments for the year. But this is dependent on funding available to engage such services. And it becomes a challenge because the department looks at its funds available closer towards the end of the financial year, and therefore, as an audit committee, we were concerned that money should be available earlier in the year if such a need arises. And then lastly, which is not covered in the audit committee report on page 94-95, is a meeting that we had with the minister in August this year. It was the first such meeting where we just spoke about what we actually do and what are the challenges we are faced with. And I'm just going to go through these points that we raised with the minister. Firstly, we felt that the department needed skills audit for the whole department by an independent service provider. You heard from the other presenters the challenges of adequate and relevant competency skills, and this is affecting the not only the work but the reports that are presented. As an audit committee, we go a little bit beyond what we are supposed to do in terms of an oversight responsibility, but in order to assist, we also affirm that the department needs a skill audit, and management has accepted our comment on that, and so did the minister. We, as an audit committee, have a role to play to make sure that there's a balance between internal and external audit in terms of avoiding duplication of work, and make sure that the work is properly planned and the time has been properly used and the reports are forthcoming timelessly. The third point is, as an audit committee, we identified, I'm sure you all know, King 3 and one of the new requirements of King 3 that organizations, especially in the private sector, needs an ethics and social committee. But this committee felt that as much as this is a government department, but in view of the importance of the department to the greater public, it is appropriate to have an ethics and social committee. And we heard one of the speakers talk about the environmental aspects. And this is precisely what an ethics and social committee deals with. It's not only just a financial and governance matters, but also the responsibility to society. In this regard, I must say that the minister supported this request and they will be looking at it. The next point is another challenge for the audit committee. As I mentioned at the outset, we are comprised three members, but we felt that in the light of the size of the department, the responsibility and increasing role it's going to be playing into the future, ideally we need five members, three of whom are already chartered accountants. If we get another two, one would be legal and the other would be with an IT background. And that will enable the audit committee also to then allocate one of its resources to the risk management process, which I've said earlier is constrained and has made an appeal for an independent person to assist with the risk management process. The next point that we raised with the minister was the need for the enhancement of an oversight responsibility over the dollar transfers and also to the state-owned enterprise. As you've heard, 95% of the funds of the department are channeled to these parties, and we just felt that apart from relying on audited financial statements, the department had a responsibility to be involved in monitoring whether the funds were used in terms of the mandate continuously throughout the year. And then lastly, which I've alluded to, is the risk management capacity problems. At the moment, they're just two people, but there's a need for more people. And if you were to ask what is our focus going into the future as an audit committee, we're going to be focusing more on risk, on the risk management process. So, folks, that is the report of the audit committee, and thank you.
Thank you very much. Although I hope next time we won't have a plane to catch because we are rather hoping at a speed, and it's the first time I've got a presentation from the audit committee. Quite a number of good issues that they are raising, particularly issues that you shared with the minister. I'll try to talk about how that's going to be monitored and tracked along the way. Honourable members? I'm sure now we have taken copious notes, so we can go through our notes step by step with questions and comments. Who wants to go first? Honorable Failing.
Okay, thank you, Chair. I was just trying to put all my notes together and get my thoughts together. But, thank you for these very long presentations. And I think my comments will be similar to my comments that I made yesterday and my questions related to that. I'm not going to go into some of the specifics as such, but my feeling about this department, you can tell me whether I'm right or wrong on that, is that I think you've been through a bit of a messy divorce, as I said yesterday. And I think that you have spent the last 2 or 3 years trying to really establish yourself as an independent entity and get up and running and really push forward there. I think on the financial side, you seem to be doing okay, in that things seem to be ticking over and you don't have a qualified audit and you seem to be having everything in kind of working nicely in terms of that, with a few kind of provisos. But, you know, my problem with the department at the moment, and it's not necessarily directed at anyone in particular as such, but my problem with it is that we really need this department to be at the forefront of energy planning and energy policy. We really need, and the sense that I get is that for the last 2 to 3 years, we've been playing catch-up a lot of the time with policies and planning and producing the documents. As you'll see in terms of the targets, you've missed a number of targets in terms of what is required. And I think part of the blame for this is probably due to capacity within the department and trying to get all your systems in place, trying to build up your institutional capacity, all of those things. But I need you to tell me what it is that we can do to help in terms of, you know, whether it's putting pressure on Treasury, whether it's trying to look at whether we need to create more posts or how do we build more institutional capacity. But I really think that, I mean, the time has now come as such to say, how do we get this department to move from running smoothly to actually running out front and being able to set the kinds of policy parameters that we really need as a country so we can get the energy sector working. So I'd be interested to hear your kinds of responses from this. You know, what is it that's required? How do we build the capacity? And I know all of you are probably overworked, and I know you've worked very hard in terms of this year, but clearly we are not quite reaching the state where we need to reach. And if I mention a few examples, I mean, you know, when I look at the planning department, for instance, you know, you talk about the Integrated Energy Plan. I mean, the Integrated Energy Plan, you know, comes from the 2008 Energy Act. You know, essentially we should have had this thing a long time ago. And as I say, I'm not directing this at anyone specifically, but you know, clearly this has held back a lot of our planning going into the future. And so we have to get quicker on these kinds of things. We have to have faster processes. We have to produce these documents quicker. So that's the Integrated Energy Plan. The review on the Integrated Resource Plan, the IRP 2012, we still don't know what the process is in terms of how we're going to arrive at that review. What are the parameters? How are we going to do this? And it has to be out by March next year. So clearly we need to hear, you know, how are we going to meet these kinds of deadlines? But then also, you know, I mean, I think it's, you know, some of the documents which aren't mentioned here, which we should be looking at. Well, the energy efficiency strategy, I see that you said that you completed it. Because when we had energy efficiency hearings, what was very clear to us is that a number of people said we don't really have a proper energy efficiency strategy at this point in time. And we don't even have proper baselines in terms of knowing what our objectives are in the long term. So clearly we need to get that stuff right as well. We also, when you talk about energy and you talk about INEP, for instance, and you talk about how, you know, there's problems with the non-grid electrification that can't be used for cooking and heat and things like that. The point is that we really need a household energy strategy, because I don't think we should be using electricity for cooking and heating services anyway. But we need a strategy to say, how are we going to, for instance, get LPG to people's houses? How are we going to roll this out? At the moment, I just get the impression that we're trying to kind of play catch up, trying to deal with the kind of problems in the energy sector, as opposed to really pushing out front and saying, how do we give leadership? What's the end state in terms of the institutional restructure of the electricity sector that we need to see? We seem to be kind of swimming around trying to get things done, but we need to be a bit further ahead. And you need to tell us, I mean, almost like Jerry Maguire says, you know, let us, you know, help us help you. Let us know how we can really strengthen this department so that we can really build off the base that you have at the moment and really go forward, because that's what we need to do, not just for the sake of this department, but for the sake of South Africa as a whole. And I'll be interested to hear your comments on that. Thanks.
Thanks, Honourable Freeling. Honourable Smith.
Yes, yeah, I think I'll be jumping also a little bit, but you will have to have some indulgence because I've got quite a lot of issues that I would like to raise. I think from a comment side, I would like to, I'm struggling to see that there's real synergy between the entities and the department, and especially with the monitoring thereof, and achieving some of the goals. Yes, I do hear that, for example, that the study, the program that was under ESCOM, we would like to revert to another different way of doing it, you know, with a funding model. But it is making sure that the 95% of the money that you transfer, that you actually can account for that, and the outcome of that 95% is what you actually are hoping for to be getting. And when I idea that we are struggling to get information from entities in order to get a reliable information together in order to put a proper plan or a plan going forward in that specific program, it says to me then, why are we doing, why are we struggling? Aren't we looking deep enough in the Act? Aren't we looking deep enough into the regulations in order for us to make those things happening going forward? And from a internal audit side, yes, we would like to see that the managing of the finances and going forward of the institution is so much better. But then, when you raise the point of that there could be credibility of the outcome because of the lack of resources, it says to me, I question then what are the quality of the work that is being done and that is being presented. Is it being compromised, the quality thereof, or are we doing some shady work in order to get to the deadlines and missing some certain programs? Secondly, I would in a little bit more detail want to know the cost towards getting consultants in assisting the internal or possible internal audit committee vis-a-vis the actual resource of the internal committee. Is it costing us more to outsource some of those functions, or will it be better for us to beef up the committee? Just the way that we are doing business, are we being clever or are we not being clever? That's the bottom line that I'd like to get to. Just on the DG's comment on right into the beginning on the vulnerability in the various sector, are we being proactive or reactive? Have we got treaties in place to deal with circumstances that might arise? Yes, we are a new department, but it's new in standing alone. It's been there for a while, and the market is not from yesterday and the 2 years. Yes, we've taken the responsibility over the last 2 years separately, but the knowledge should have been, I would have imagined that it was with DPE, Department of Minerals, yeah, DME, and it was maybe some of that knowledge and that skill was transferred into the new Department of Energy. And I would want to understand is our bilateral trade agreements in place to deal with some of these things? 2 days ago we had a comment by the minister to say that she's on her way to finalise or hoping to finalise the whole Inga project. And it then goes a little bit more further for me to say what is happening with Mozambique, what is happening with possible Angola, possible fines, gases there. Are we securing future gains in those fields? And how do we bring in those future gains into our IRP going forward, looking at the various energy mixes being on the one side fuel and then another side liquid fuel and in the normal energy mix as well. One of the outcomes was on your outcome 12 where it speaks on effective and efficient service delivery, and it goes back to one of the emphasisms that the Auditor General brought out yesterday, the vulnerability around the supply chain management and the dealings thereof. And when I looked at some of the risk policies that are in place or the various policies in order to look at those risks, and the financial policies there. Are they efficient then to deal with that? Is the internal auditor playing its oversight role when the supply chain management issues are taking place? Because I question that some of these things could be prevented if the oversight role is playing correctly, first of all. Secondly, it's a worry factor to me that when the finance section, when you look at other departments' databases and co-opt some of those suppliers to do work for you, whatever those, because we didn't go into the detail what those are, and you take for granted that they've met all the requirements, surely you should make sure that your checks and balances are right. Are those, because I know that local municipalities not necessarily update all their databases on a yearly basis due to the capacity programs. It's a matter of adding, and tax clearance forms, especially, is a yearly thing, and that has got to be awarded out, and no tender should be awarded out. The public, particularly yesterday, announces herself to various other issues surrounding tax clearance certificates, where we award tenders, where especially such a thing is not being awarded out. And I'm concerned when we don't do the checks and balances, and we rely on another department to do the checks and balances on our behalf or on your behalf, and then there's no sort of a it's not been confirmed by them that all these checks and balances are in place. So that if accountability should take place and action should be take place, where does the blame go? Because at the end of the day, you are held responsible for your finances in this department. But when we need to go to a civil case or to the next case, and it's got and the serious matters of concern, where do we stop? On corporate services, the establishment of the knowledge and the management center, the information going forward from that, does that include some of the short, is the planning of that and the information that you deal with, does that also include some of the concerns that the entities faces with? Is that part of that function? I'm trying to understand how far your thinking is going forward. Or is it totally just surrounded with the department itself and not looking at some of the strategies towards the management of or improving the knowledge of those other sectors? I just need to understand that. When various presenters touched on EDI holdings, there were references made that I think one stage there was 11.8 million rand on the very last, on the annual report, and then there was when we closed business, it was at 400 million. I'm trying to understand how did we get from 400 million to 11.8 million. Secondly, on that same question is that the possible cost of the CCMA case of maybe at a cost of 29 million and towards the department and the litigation process, the legal cost in fighting that. Is it surpassing how far that goes? 20%, our case defending that, our efforts in defending that, is it realistic in trying to get to a settlement? Sometimes what we do is we settle, of course, the legal fees and the legal cost to go to the extent, sometimes more than what we wanted for, and I'm just trying to balance. I don't want to see the department going to a court case of 10 million rand and then we settle for 15 million rand, and then we could have just paid the 29 million rand. I'm just trying to see that. Or what are we anticipating, or what are the possibilities there? I'll get to the email stuff now. I'm just trying to understand. If I go to myself, take another bite. If you want to allow other people, I don't mind you stopping me.
Well, that's the last question.
Okay, that is all often, so I'm not so worried about that. I heard the DG said that, just trying to get the wording right, that when we looked at bronze performances, especially on the targets that we couldn't, on the monitoring and the evaluation reporting system and getting the targets that we are getting, and looking that we will review this in a short space of time in order to get that. It is, for me, that is most probably your most important section within your department. It's not something that I can see you do without, or the department should not be doing it without. It's either finding cuts somewhere else than not cutting on this, because this will have an impact on your actual service delivery, on where you want to go, and reaching your goals and stuff. And what I'm hoping for is trying to get the assurance from you that that your monitoring section of that will be fast in going forward. Check. I will take another.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. I'm sensing a general outcry from the Department for Finances and Resources. And Mr. Ngo go so far as in that slide, 37 on page 19, to say that 43% was due to overestimating what they were going to get, so much so that now the way forward is to review somewhere midterm and see how to go forward. I'm not sure whether this is because it's a new department, they're not given a 3-year cycle, so you can have a sense as to what is it that is going to be happening 2-3 years. I get a sense they have a problem of planning because they don't know what funding or resources. When you go to the internal audit, they are saying the same outline, crying about resources and this and that. Which means, I think maybe we need to do something if necessary, because without that funding and finances, we are going to be constantly saying, why didn't you do what you do? But my main concern is to be so out of resources that you cannot even plan ahead. If I go to slide 46, I think that is Mr. Mokubela, on page 23. In that slide, he was saying the reference bulletin increased in turnaround time for process of all applications that meet the acceptance criteria, and saying their main problem there is that those who are submitting, they don't submit all the information. And every stage, they are saying, what do we do? If you submit your thing, you don't get everything. Let's throw it out. Let it mess us out. That worries me. It worries me because I'm not saying I'm worrying about what he's saying. I'm worried about that general expectation that you are at fault when you can prove that this application didn't meet the criteria. So I don't know at what stage that this needs to be taken, even if it needs to be taken with the order. To cut somebody totally out because he didn't, to me, that's why. I'm saying that is something that needs to be addressed head-on, and a formal decision be taken on that. If I go to slide 49, I think Mr. Kola again was saying these different structures are reluctant to bring about the necessary data. And he was saying he was not sure whether they must not be forced to become compulsory. My question is, who is going to take that decision? If in order to do what need to be done depends on somebody who needs to be submitting data, is it not necessary to change and then make it compulsory? Otherwise, we're going to be crying year in, year out. I'm just crying out for a policy decision on that. If I go to internal audit, the slide is 11. It says they are saying that they are needing the ethics, establishing of a ethics and social committee. My question is this need peculiar to this department? Is this department so peculiar that it will need that structure, or is it something that we need to be putting out for the department generally, so that it becomes a government issue, not something that relates to this department? Thank you, sir.
Okay. Let me throw in my bit as well, but questions for now. You know, the question I had initially, when as Nedi said, you know, the strategic plan is based on several assumptions, was that then how could risk management not pick up or prepare for worst case scenarios? But I suppose then the fact that you took long in formulating a risk management strategy and implementing it may have been one of the reasons. I'd like to get a comment on that. Once again, we look at the department's response to government outcomes. A question comes up that what has been the role and the impact of the department in its coordinating work as a lead department in specific projects that it was assigned to? Surely there are projects in that department, or projects that the department takes as a lead department. And also being curious that if there's any branch within the department that oversees this function. Take into account to the year we are under consideration now. I'm looking at page 5, slide 10. Reference is made there on the vacancy rate of 9.6. Now the question I have is it on the interim or the permanent organogram? And there's something that I just want to be educated on there. You make reference to baseline of 15%. What is that? Can you expatiate on it? Regarding training, you say you managed to train 443 employees out of what target? Would be keen to know what were you targeting here in the first place. And also, in this regard, that of skills or to develop training, from what Mr. Bakuba said, the young reference to young staff, one would have expected that, or one would like to hear the extent to which
training plan has taken on board this unique character of the age profile. Because it obviously doesn't have to an extent implications, particularly when he was raising the challenges. There's little detail, or a little bit of detail would be welcome on legal services front. When you say legal services, you have a target of 50%. I mean, you don't anticipate cases arise when people challenge you on one side, but there could be contracts as well, which probably are handled by legal services. I'm just provoking this because I see you've got said 50% exceeded to 60%. That's why I'm also requesting a little bit just to understand exactly what you do in legal services, such that you have targets. Your publication services were also established. How? Where are they distributed? Was they haven't shared any with us? Regarding the challenges of inadequate baseline allocation, that's referenced to page 9 to slide 17. What I'm interested in is the extent to which you have sorted out any consensus on the baseline itself. Unless you are saying you've come up with a different solution with the National Treasury. I'm saying this because from my side as a chair, I've tried to ensure that we give hand, but the department prefers to take it on its own. So it's fine, that can be done, but we just would like to be clear and be assured that this engagement between Treasury and Energy is not just going to be an endless engagement. Some certainty must come out of that, and amongst a host of things, one would like to know that the department has been complaining about the distorted baseline upon which it was born. Has that been sorted out? As far as I'm concerned, as long as there's no consensus on the baseline with National Treasury, he will always be given inadequate amount. They can say we've given you 60% increase, but it depends on the baseline that has been agreed upon. With regard to allocations, next about 586 million, one would just be interested as to what could have been the ideal amount which could have been given to Nexa, because Nexa keeps on as indicated severe financial challenges. The multi-purpose pipeline. Earlier, when you shared with us on that, it was indicated that the pipeline was just run with diesel. The question is it still diesel only? If yes, why? I mean, I say that because one would expect that the other forms, other fuels would have to be pushed into the pipeline at some stage to meet the demands inland, Gauteng in particular. A little bit of delay as well, maybe because I'm in Gauteng and in Joburg, in fact, as to the illegal fuel sale.
Where and how is that done?
With regards to the Integrated Energy Center program, we did, when we went to Etegwini in January, we had some disturbing stories about the Integrated Energy Center in Newcastle, completed but almost mothballed or standing idle. Has that issue been sorted out? Because there are risks of vandalism if it had not yet started. The completion of the IEP in the same slide, 47, triggers my question that the extent to which we are handling data management or collection in particular, one would like to know that, if SANED is playing a role on that issue. And on the same issue under when looking at challenges, one begins to ask is the department trying to of intention or in whatever way seized with a strategy on one side and regulations around the use of data management? Because ever since I joined this department, I've always picked up this lamentation that we are well behind data management in the energy sector. On nuclear energy, I think, I hope I'm right here. I see in the current financial aid, one of the delays was the National Radioactive Waste Disposal Institute. The question I'd like to know, Debo Bambo, is that isn't this institute one of the necessary facilities in preparation for the new nuclear build program? Then one can comment once you respond to that. Sorry, I wrote on the document itself. Coming to the energy efficiency institutional arrangements, I see in slide 77 in that flowchart, there's an indication when it comes to the National Energy Efficiency Agency. It says savings. Now, the question to me, why? Does it mean that this agency is going to get funding through savings only? What about the NASA-based or the NASA-initiated funding arrangements? Maybe the other question is that exactly what does this what are these institutional arrangements telling us? Is that there's going to be a number of institutions that are driving energy efficiency? Isn't there supposed to be a central coordinating platform that ensures that energy efficiency is driven? And there's an acronym there which one doesn't understand as well. It's ESCO. What is that? IBT. I've had a practical experience on IBT, the unintended consequences of it. When you have someone having back rooms and people staying in back rooms, and the person, the landlord, instead of getting the benefits of IDT, what happens that the bill gets higher because the consumption, according to records, is seen as being higher, whereas it's because of multiple occupation. I've picked up when it problems in Chalelo, to be exact, in Soweto. Our comrade, amongst other things, raised that very sharply. And we did check with ESCOM. Now the question is of the department, has there been any remedial action initiated within this current, which is this year, 2011-2012, on that? Also on this, the next round of tariff determination is supposed to be completed by March 2013. But up to now, we haven't had anything presented and put on the table. Has the department ensured that this March 2013 target is still realistic? This is going to be a sensitive thing, so we need to be very, very key and assured on that one. So going back to slide 80 once again in page 40, you make reference there that other projects on Adam are going to be in key municipalities. Before one gets excited about key municipalities, what criteria are going to, or are you putting on the table to identify those key municipalities? The CDM, one of the challenges in the CDM is the small projects being able to submit applications. And under this very year, to what extent have you tried to address that in terms of supporting small projects so that we can have more and more of this, including the funding strategy, obviously, not just submitting the application? Still in slide 87, unless I missed it, because I think we moved very, very fast there. Regarding the revamp of the regulatory framework for new energy generation capacity and determinations under electricity regulations to introduce IPPs, what I'm interested there, what was done during 2011-2012 on those two areas? On slide 101, regarding slow rollout on non-grid connections due to negative political perceptions, in particular, what remedial action was taken on that? Could be an interesting thing to know what was happening. Regarding the Audit Committee, I think it's a very encouraging review, but them, Zipalan was referring at times to current year. Now when you say current year, we're in October 2012. Does it mean this current financial year or the current year is 2011-2012? I got a bit confused on that. And also, quite a lot of reference was made to internal audit function. It might be helpful just for internal audit itself to just indicate to us the extent to which they've been able to perform their work, you know, vis-a-vis issues that have been raised by the audit committee itself. I'm sure one of the members have covered quite a number of other details, so mine's more of a broad sweeping inquiry around the report of the audit committee. The extent, as I said, with the audit committee that it is able to do its job and get the findings. Not the findings by the AG, no. I see the time is right to 1. Professor Gordon would like to take leave sooner than later. Can you make a deal? Let's have him to respond to his questions and release him, eat lunch, and come back.
have the department respond to the rest of the questions. Over to you, Professor Kwame.
Thank you, Chair. I've recorded 4 questions for the Audit Committee. Not 4, sorry. 3. The first one was the need for a Social and Ethics Committee. You're quite right in asking whether it pertains to all government departments or particularly to the Department of Energy. My response would be that ideally it should be relevant for all government departments because they all have a responsibility to the greater public. But in the light of the importance of the Department of Energy and the role it plays, there's no harm in it taking the lead. I know the King V Code, as I said, pertains mainly to the private sector, but one could take the cue from the King Code and apply to the public sector as well. Then there was a question on the risk management, the worst case scenario. In the light of the development of the risk process in terms of the appointments, we feel that it will be dependent on the effectiveness of this office. But needless to say, not that the department is oblivious to this responsibility. They've had strategic workshops or seminars in 2010 and 2011, and as much as the risk function itself is under-resourced, but the department as a whole is looking at the responsibility overall. I would like to hand over to my colleague on my left here on the internal audit questions. There were 3, sorry, but there was one more question and that came from the chairman on my reference to the current year. What I reported on was mainly up to the 31st of March 2012, but where I did use the word current year, I don't know in what aspect, but it was something that developed subsequent to the year end. If I can elaborate, if you tell me specifically which part I made reference to current year. But as I said, the report was based mainly on the year ended 31st March 2012.
No, that's fine. That's fine.
Chair, thank you very much. On the question of the reliability or credibility of the work of internal audit, if I can just give some background on this one. Internal auditors get audited 2 times. There is something known as quality assurance review, the one that the chairperson has referred to earlier on. The external review of the work of internal auditors, whether it meets the standards or not. And secondly, the Office of the Auditor General, in order for them to reduce their procedures on the audit of financial statements, they have got to take a look at the work that internal audit has done during the course of the year. I can say it here, Chairperson, proudly, that the Office of the Auditor General has placed reliance on the work of internal audit, and a significant amount of audit fees have been realized by savings on audit fees has been realized by the department thereof. Auditors have got to comply with the standards and a code of ethics that requires them to complete work competently. And I can say as well in relation to that one of the measures that the AG uses in measuring the effectiveness of internal audit is as to whether the internal audit function was able to complete the planned audits by the end of the year. And for the Department of Energy, internal audit, I can say yes, and there is no line in the AG management letter that questions the effectiveness of internal audit. Just over and above that I've mentioned, the reliance by the Auditor General on the work of internal audit. That might have some side effects, probably, because with the staff. There has to be some harsh, you know, managerial practices that might not be good for the some staff. Staff might be overworked. There might be a high staff turnover, etc. Side effects of high products. But I can say that the auditors are performing their work reliably, and the auditor general relies on that. On the question of the core sourcing as a measure that the department is taking in as far as augmenting the current or existing capacity of internal audit. Well, in the short term, here I will speak independently, objectively, like an auditor. In the short term, co-sourcing is a less expensive or less costly practice kind of alternative for the department, in that in a co-sourcing arrangement, the department is not obliged to pay monthly salaries on a continuous basis. It pays for those specific audits during the time the audit has come. But that as well has got its, you know, long-term implications, in that the co-sourced firms, they only come once. They don't have loyalty for the organization. They might not have organizational memory that a staff member might have internally. But the department is, you know, constrained with funding. I'm sure that the DG and the senior management would like to capacitate internal audit to a level that might be, in the long term, you know, the advantageous to the department. Yeah, that is as far as the processing arrangement is concerned. I believe that from what I have heard, because as head of internal audit, I've tried to motivate for internal capacity on a consistent basis together with the audit committee. But there is funding constraints. The answer that I have got is that the department cannot be able to afford that constant cost at the moment. Also, I would just like to mention that the processing arrangement might have some, you know, long-term effects of staff turnover, related effects to staff turnover, in that employees do not see career growth in an organization where the division is not growing. You know, they would obviously be a training ground for other organizations. But that, I take it, as teasing progress of a new department. Okay, in as far as the role taken by internal audit in the supply chain and compliance environment, the internal audit function serves as an observer member in the bid adjudication committees. That is where the consulting role is exercised, in that the internal audit in there would point out issues before they are discovered by the AG, would point out risks to transactions that are going to be taken, and alternative courses of action by the department might be taken. That is apart from the fact that audits are planned and performed in the supply chain environment before the AG comes, and follow-up audits are planned, to ensure that whatever has been recommended has been implemented by the supply chain management functions. You know, that is the contribution of internal audit towards the supply chain management and compliance thereof. But I would just like to mention the fact that the nature of services that the department requires from, for example, third parties like the municipality, that for a PPP public participation program, for example, the nature of the procurement in there, you know, might be, has got its characteristics of a rushed kind of service, but with the recommendations that have been made by the internal and the external auditors, and the commitment from the supply chain management, to mention the finance section,
we have seen drastic reduction in non-compliance issues in that area. All of these areas that have been mentioned, the work of non-submission of tax clearance certificates, etc., etc., internal audit, just apart from the audits, is involved in a consulting role. So those that might be at a very high level, the time might be limited when that is being done. But that acts as a deterrent even on somebody who would be willing to do that without to arrest what is required by regulations. On the, if I can add just one, what the person has mentioned, as far as the risk management function is concerned. For internal audit plans to be reliable and to be relied on by the AG, the risk management function has got to identify the entire risk management, risks within the organization. And internal audit in here as well acts a consulting role of helping in the facilitation and their audits that are being done, checking as to whether the risk identification process has been complete, etc., etc. And checking as to whether the functions that are required to be performed by the risk management committees, whether risk is being monitored, is being done by internal audit. Thank you, Chair.
Suppose then you ensure that you don't have a repute of the Palama situation in whatever form and character it takes in future, because if you play that consulting role, then you assume that you also had a hawk's eye when all these things are done. But we take into account that it's not the ideal situation, because with the hundreds of these procurements, they take it in one time. One doesn't have an idea, but obviously one is also quite aware of that. But hopefully, remember the bottom line, I'd like to repeat that, I think Professor Gordon was there when the Auditor General said this department is one of the departments which can, within record time, have a clean audit. The department itself, as well as the state-owned enterprises. And I would like us, honorable members, to ensure the push for that. There's someone, I think, that helps us to help you. That's why I'm reading that. Honorable members, ladies and gentlemen, let's speak again back at 2 o'clock. Thank you very much. There's lunch provided outside.